Afghanistan, the 13-year war against the Taliban has left thousands of Afghan and foreign soldiers dead. But what happens to the widows and families left behind? I am Zarghuna Kargar, and in this week's BBC World Service documentary, The War Widows of Afghanistan, British and Afghan women describe how their lives changed the instant they received the news of their husband's death.
It must have been about 5:30, and there was a knock at the door. And when I answered the door, and there was two men dressed in black, and they flashed the army ID card. And they just said, "Just need to inform you that your husband's dead," and that was it.
I heard the noise of a car arriving. It was snowing outside. My son called out, "It's Daddy!" I went out and saw him in the coffin, surrounded by a lot of soldiers. They had shot him in his heart. When they brought his body, I flung myself on him and started screaming.
It was very late on the 13th of April, and two officers from the Royal Air Force came to the house to tell us personally that Gary had been killed in Afghanistan. Gary and his colleague were on the way back to Kandahar. Their vehicle went over an anti-tank mine. I honestly felt, when they told me, that I'd been hit with the train. I felt I couldn't breathe. I just could not stop shaking.
Sharma, you know,
my husband, he was on duty, clearing the mines. His vehicle hit a mine. He was blasted into pieces. When I received the news, I became like a dead body myself. Suddenly, the whole world stopped.
Lisa, Tajbibi, Jackie, and Marzia. Four women living in very different places, but widowed by the same war. The war in Afghanistan that began in 2001 and officially ends with the withdrawal of NATO troops this year. An estimated 13,000 men in the Afghan National Security Force and 453 British soldiers are amongst the many tens of thousands who have died in the 13 years of conflict with the Taliban, leaving behind families, dependents, and loved ones.
Obviously, I know that they're in the army and their job is to go out and fight, and that's as I see it.
Lisa, age 34, lives near the town of Preston in northern England with her 13-year-old daughter.
I don't understand the politics thing. I just know that John chose his job, and part of his job is going out to Afghanistan, and in that job he might well shoot somebody, and actually he might get shot himself. Never thought it would happen because he was the cat with nine lives.
When she met John McKinley, a soldier with the Rifles Regiment, she says it was love at first sight.
To find out he was in the army was a bit of a, oh, but you know, you can't choose who you fall for. And he was very fit. He was very fit. He used to actually drive home in his uniform because I liked him to walk through the door in his uniform.
John had already served in Iraq and Northern Ireland and went to Afghanistan in 2011.
Did he think it was an important war to fight?
He did think it was an important war to fight because it was giving the Afghanists back their territory almost.
My husband hated the Taliban. He used to say we will die rather than let the Taliban run our country. Sometimes when he turned on the radio, there would be Taliban chanting. He would swear and turn it off.
Tajbibi, age 40, mother of three, is from a Pashtun family, and as is the custom, she had an arranged marriage. The man chosen by her parents was a soldier in the Afghan army.
When he saw me, he said, "I like her. She's fat and big, and I want to marry her because I like fat women." So I said, "Yes, I'll marry him." Look at this picture. See how good looking he was. He had big eyes. He was clever and he was smart. He used to wear white clothes and was always clean-shaven. I liked his face. I was very happy. He was a good man. He told me he loved me. And I told him, yes, I love you back.
Taj Bibi and her husband went to live in Logar province in central Afghanistan, where he was posted. It's only about an hour's drive from the capital city of Kabul, but the Taliban have a significant presence there. The local villagers were mostly Taliban supporters and did not like Taj Bibi's husband working for the government, especially when he became a translator for the American army.
Whenever he went out, I was scared of the village people, because they might burn his car or put a bomb in his way. When he reached his workplace, he would call me and say that he had reached safely. And I would tell him that everything is also okay for me. He loved being a soldier. I used to tell him, if you die, I will be alone. What will happen to us? He would reply, but if I stay at home, what will we eat?
Back in England, Lisa and John got married before he left for his second tour in southern Afghanistan in the summer of 2011.
When he went out with the rifles, it was a particularly bad tour. That there was too many of them in that short space of time within the same group, injured or killed.
One of their closest friends in the same battalion was killed just 2 months before John. The news came as a big shock.
It was just awful. He was in tears, I was in tears. I just said, oh, I just want you to come home. When you get home, you're signing out, I've had enough. This isn't the life. And then bizarrely, it turned out to be him next.
Lisa remembers September the 14th, when she had her last contact with John.
On the morning before he was shot, he texts me, just as usual, hey babe, how are you doing? Going out on patrol soon, this, that and the other, love you. He was out on patrol with an Afghan soldier and they were ambushed. John was shot in the leg and he was shot through the neck. They saw him go down in the field and they thought he was just trying to stay low. So when they went out to get him, that's when they realised that he was dead. I spent the night trying to convince myself that it wasn't John and texting him to text me back, but obviously he didn't.
In Afghanistan, women pray every day that they should not receive sudden news of death. But for Taj Bibi, the news she had been dreading came all too abruptly one evening, 7 years ago. Her husband had been on his way to work.
I heard he had been shot. There were phone calls, but I didn't know what was going on. I told my son to find out what's happening. Then I heard the noise of a car arriving. My son called out, "It's Daddy!" I went out and saw him in the coffin, surrounded by a lot of soldiers. They had shot him in his heart, and his uniform was like a sieve, full of holes. It was sunset when I heard. I lost all sense of what was happening. I had just given birth to my daughter. When they brought his body, I flung myself on him and started screaming.
I've lost the person that I was supposed to spend the rest of my life with. It hurts, it physically aches. But it is like a heartbreak.
I cannot forget him. People say he was martyred, and I should accept it. But I say no. My new baby daughter died of starvation because I neglected her. I can't tell you how bad it was. During daytime, I keep busy, but in the night, I can't sleep. It feels like he's standing in front of me.
I've just never been through anything quite like this in my life, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody either. The fallout after grief is immense. Still 2.5 years on, I'm not doing very well, you know. John's the one that buzzes around my head 24/7. It's just like a constant niggle. It's like there's no peace.
Lisa says she has had fantastic support from her family and from the army in Britain. She continues her work as a health visitor, and John's army pension means that financially her circumstances have not really changed. But for Taj Bibi, things could not be more different. Her husband's family disowned her after failing to persuade her to marry another man in their family. Without a husband, Taj Bibi found herself without status or a means to keep a roof over her head. She came back to her parents' house in Kabul, where she's only allowed to work at home. So she ekes out a living doing laundry for her brothers and neighbors. Taj Bibi's situation is typical of many of Afghanistan's estimated 2 million war widows. Women like Taj Bibi just don't know how to negotiate the bureaucracy of getting what government support is available.
Because I lost my husband's ID card when he died, I can't claim his pension. I don't know where the office is. He used to do everything. I'm not used to Kabul city. I don't know how to claim for anything. A man, he can do it. But without a man, how can I do it? I was the wife of a big man, but now I have become like a beggar. My children weren't all dusty like they are now. They used to wear shirts and jeans. Now they do not even have sandals. This morning, I cried to see them barefoot.
Back in England, I played some of our recording of Taj Bibi for Lisa to hear.
I think there's a huge disparity between how they live and how I live. I mean, the grieving process, try and empathise with for her. But again, I've got masses of support. I've got a pension that John's left behind that enables me to survive. Obviously, it was a panic when John first left, but at the end of the day, I would just work more hours because I've got that option. I've got my career, so I've got that to fall back on. If this lady's not allowed to even leave her own compound, well, I don't know how I'm supposed to survive.
This is the BBC World Service, and you are listening to the War Widows of Afghanistan with me, Zarghuna Kargar. Afghanistan is a poor country. UN estimates show that 85% of women here are illiterate. Men are the main breadwinners of their families. So when a husband dies, women struggle to find food and raise children. But the pain of being a widow comes not just from poverty.
From very young age until now, I have woven these carpets. This is how I have lived my life.
Marzia, age 26, mother of two, is from the minority Uzbek tribe, and she was brought up in a remote area in the north of Afghanistan, where the Taliban have increased their attacks and control. She has worked as a carpet weaver since she was a child, because during the Taliban rule, girls were not allowed to go to school.
I was in grade one when Taliban came. I had just started to learn the alphabet when I had to leave school. Now I can only read signs and write my name.
At the age of 19, like for many other Afghan girls, her parents arranged her marriage to a man she didn't know. He was also an illiterate carpet weaver, but once he had a family to support, he decided to join the army.
I was against him becoming a soldier. I told him, now he has a wife and two children. He should find a job where he could go in the morning and come back in the evening. But he didn't listen to me. He said if everyone says that they cannot fight because they have a wife and children, then what will happen to our country? What will happen to Afghanistan's future?
But one day in 2010, when her husband had only been in the army for 6 months, Marzia received what would be her last phone call from him.
That day he called me at 8 o'clock in the morning. He said that there were only 2 days left until he could come home. He said there is nothing to worry about. I was so happy. He spoke to me at 8, and it was around 12:30 in the afternoon the incident happened.
Marzia's husband's job involved making safe an area where the Taliban regularly planted mines.
My husband was on duty with his commander, clearing mines. During the day, they cleared an area, but the Taliban would come back at night and plant them again. They thought they were passing through a cleared area. Their car had a huge mine. The front of his car was totally destroyed. My husband and his commander died at the scene. One man was thrown in one direction and my husband the other. His right leg was blown off. It's very hard to talk about it.
Being a soldier's wife in Afghanistan means death is never far away. But for wives of foreign troops, the risk seems more remote.
My name is Jacqueline Thompson, and my husband Gary was a reservist in the Royal Auxiliary Air Force, which meant that he wasn't permanently in the military. He had a full-time job as a sheet metal worker within his own company in Nottingham. And in February 2008, Gary was deployed to Afghanistan. I actually drove him to RAF Wittering, where he would be then leaving for Afghanistan. I remember Gary going into the car and getting all his kit, closing the door, rushing off to the gate. I said, Gary. He said, what? I said, have you forgotten something? He went, what? I said, me. I said, come back and give me a kiss. And he kind of like, you know, like a kid at school. Oh, right then. So come. And he just gave me a peck on the cheek and then started running off to base again. That's the last peck on the cheek I got from my husband.
To try and stop them from worrying, Gary had told his family that he was just going to be doing an office job and that he would be in no danger. In fact, he was helping to provide security for the airfields.
The last time I spoke to Gary on the telephone was the day before he was killed, and he was talking about how he couldn't wait to come home on his R&R, which he had 2 weeks off in May. And on the 13th of April 2008, we heard that Gary, along with a colleague, had been killed in Afghanistan, obviously leaving me behind and his five daughters as well. Gary and his colleague were doing top cover in a vehicle coming on the way back to Kandahar. Their vehicle went over an anti-tank mine.
Gary Thompson was 51 when he died. He was the oldest British casualty at the time.
When they brought Gary's coffin off the plane, I don't think you could be ever prepared for the blast of emotion that hits you, because all of a sudden that's real. You know, that was Gary. I was never going to see him again. The girls just went to pieces. I just felt as a mum, this was the time I couldn't do anything to help them. I couldn't make it better. I couldn't say it was going to be all right. Gary will never be around to see his kids finish growing up, having families of their own, his grandchildren. It's all gone.
At the beginning, they told me not to look at the body. I didn't know what condition he was in. But I wanted to see him, because otherwise you will never accept his death. Still now, my heart doesn't accept it. I cannot believe it. Whenever I open the door, I think I will see him coming home with his briefcase. They brought him in a military plane from the place where the explosion happened. They put him in a coffin. They brought him at 8 o'clock in the morning. At 2 o'clock, the soldier took him back and buried him. They placed him with pride.
When Gary's car, the coffin, turned into the church, you just seen a row of blue, really, from the Royal Air Force. They were all in their military uniforms. They just looked so smart, and I just felt it was such a fitting tribute to Gary as well. They made me feel that Gary was incredibly special.
Adjusting to life without Gary has been hard, but Jackie and her daughters were able to remain in their family home and cherish their happy memories there. But for widows in Afghanistan, that is often not possible.
For the 40 days mourning period, I stayed with my in-laws. Then I came to my parents' house because my father came and said he wanted to take his daughter back and that a young woman cannot stay alone with her in-laws. Living an independent life is very good. Who wouldn't want to? But I can't because I am a young woman with two kids. How can I live on my own? Independent life means house expenses. I would have to pay rent. I can't afford that. I don't have a job. I can't stand on my own two feet.
For young women, widowhood is like a prison sentence. Marzia can only remain in her parents' house and weave carpets all day. As to leave the house is to invite gossip.
I've had enough of weaving. People think that when a woman becomes a widow, she becomes loose and immoral. They think we are like a pot with no lid, uncovered and ready to do anything. This is wrong. They don't know that a widow also has a heart. She is a woman. She has dreams. She also wants a good life.
Back in Britain, Jackie reflected on what Marzia had said.
I've always lived in England where I've been able to make my own choices, my own decisions, and encourage my girls to be able to do that. They've been able to decide what university they go to. They've been able to decide if they want to do travelling. You know, we're incredibly blessed. I can't imagine not being able to make those decisions for myself.
One of the biggest catch-22s for an Afghan widow is that she cannot regain any status or economic security unless she remarries. But in Afghanistan, the law permits the husband's family to take custody of children if the widow remarries outside of his family.
I have decided not to remarry because if I did, my in-laws might take my children away. I'm very afraid of this.
Like all the widows I spoke to in Afghanistan and Britain, Marzia's hopes and dreams are now for her children.
My children were young when their father died. Now my son is 6. I have admitted him to school. I want him to fulfill his father's dreams. He said I couldn't get an education, but my son should. Whenever he went on duty, he said, if anything happens to me, don't let my son be illiterate. I want him to become an engineer or a doctor. My wish is that my children grow up well-behaved and educated and become good human beings. This is all I wish and hope for.
As the deadline for the foreign troops' withdrawal approaches later this year, I wondered how the British widows, Jackie and Lisa, feel about the sacrifices they have made. Has the war been worth it?
Yeah. It's not an easy question to answer because so many people have given their lives for it. Could I really turn around and say it was for nothing? No, I couldn't.
John was doing his job and that's how I've maintained it. If I started going down the lines of whether or not I think it was a waste or was it worth it, it's like Pandora's box. So I just view it that he did his job and he loved his job. And in fairness, he wouldn't have wanted to go any other way.
I get asked, are you mad with the military? Are you mad with the government? You know, people in Afghanistan. I'm not angry with any of them. I think the soldiers, I've got a lot of respect and admiration for them. I think they've got a very tough job. And the people in Afghanistan, I don't hold them at all responsible. They're as much a victim as anybody else, really.
Although there are some people who question what the foreign troops in Afghanistan have achieved, speaking to many Afghan women, I have never heard anything but gratitude for the fact that roads have been built, schools reopened, and many areas made safer by their presence.
It is because the foreign troops have come, we have some stability. If they had not come, I don't know what would have happened to Afghanistan. I'm glad that the foreigners came to our country. They have families, yet they sacrifice their lives for Afghanistan's security. From one side, the Taliban come to destroy, and from the other side, the foreigners come to build this country. We are proud of them. They are human beings, and they also suffer. I understand this.
I'm so pleased to hear that. Because Gary's given his life for that, I'm glad that there's somebody out there on the other side that I haven't met who's appreciated what Gary's done and what the others have done.
Despite the painful price her family has paid, Marzia also recognises her husband's contribution to the future of Afghanistan.
He served his country from the bottom of his heart. Now I can only say that he was a hero who sacrificed his own life for his country and for the security of his people. I know his place will be in paradise.
The War Widows of Afghanistan was presented by me, Zarghuna Kargar, and the producer was Mukti Jain Campion. It was a CultureWise production for BBC World Service. Documentary.